Lecture 23, European Cultural and Intellectual Life.
Hello. We've been talking for the past several lectures about a mounting crisis in European domestic politics, a crisis of liberalism, a crisis of middle-class politics, a growing, in a sense, an odd and ironic situation in which Europe, at the very pinnacle of its power, the pinnacle of its influence in the 19th century, also saw undercurrents which tended to threaten the stability, threaten comfortable assumptions about the way society worked, about the way the economy worked, and challenge the very optimistic notion of the future which had been inherent in liberal philosophy. In this lecture and in our next lecture, we're going to shift our focus to the arts, to philosophy, to science. We're in the last half of the 19th century and in those years down to the outbreak of the Great War. There would also be a challenge to the exalted status of humankind, of humanity, posed by science on the one hand, and then a challenge to accepted belief that would arise in the scientific field but would quickly expand into art, into philosophy, providing for an extraordinarily rich cultural outpouring in the late 19th century, but one that produced a good deal of discomfort as well among not only the established elites but what might be called the hegemonic cultural domination of the European middle class. I'd like to begin with a discussion of Darwin, the Darwinian Revolution. Charles Darwin had published his initial findings, The Origin of Species, in 1859 after a five-year-long voyage on the ship the Beagle, in which he traveled around the world gathering, observing items from the natural world. That publication, Origin of Species, would be followed in 1871 with his Descent of Man, which together set off a scientific and cultural revolution. I think one of the remarkable features of Darwinian thought and the career of Charles Darwin was that his impact was not simply in the scientific community, the naturalist community, but rather would take on far more significant cultural significance, even political significance as well. His theory was a scientific, secular explanation of the evolution of humankind, and it shocked his contemporaries, particularly churchmen. Scientists such as T.H. Huxley rushed to defend Darwin, but the theory of evolution, as it was called, seemed to be an assault on the very foundations of received religious wisdom, a challenge to the accepted notion of the way in which the world had been created, the way in which humanity had progressed. Challenges to the biblical version of creation had been mounted before, as early as the first decade of the 19th century. But Darwin's was a far more cautious, careful, scientific examination of these issues, and it posed a far greater threat. His argument that man had descended from lower orders, the usual shorthand for this of man descending from the apes, seemed to be part of that man was, in fact, part of the animal kingdom. This, which seems like a fairly obvious sort of observation to make, that humankind is part of a larger animal kingdom, was a real shock to 19th century notions of mankind as quite qualitatively different from any other sort of living, breathing creatures on the planet. It was a move that seemed to not only strike at the religious notions that had guided Western civilization about creation, the nature of man, but also about man himself, that human beings were, in fact, simply part of a larger animal kingdom. This debate, this argument, produced by Darwin's work had ripple effects that would extend out beyond Oxbridge, beyond the famous Huxley debate with a noted theologian in the 19th century, in which the theologian attempted to downplay Darwin's theory, asking his audience if anyone there felt comfortable thinking of his ancestors as apes. Huxley would respond that the only thing he was embarrassed about would have been to be related to anyone who could make light of such a serious scientific theory.